Okay, so this is Parshas Chukas, the title of the class called Miriam and Woman Power. And we begin with a video called Teen Elephants Gone Wild. So the situation was like this. Let's put it on. Let me see if it explains it. If not, I'll give the context later on.
More dangerous on earth than an elephant bull in must.
The troubled teenagers were entering must far too early.
Must is basically the same thing as the word for when they're in heat for elephants. M-U-S-T. Fine.
There seemed to be only one likely explanation, the absence of older males to curb their youthful exuberance. The young bulls needed role models.
The bulls rely on a slow introduction to must. When he's in his middle 20s, he might just pop into must for a day or two and then be beaten by a bigger bull who's been in must for a while. Obviously, the philanthropic bulls at the time didn't have that. They were coming into must early and they were just having these unbelievably long, extended must periods. And those were quite clearly leading to rhino mortalities.
The case of the dead rhinos was closed. The worst of the culprits were condemned to death to protect the rhinos and everyone else. But removing the killer elephants didn't tackle the root of the problem.
We were reluctant, quite obviously, to just keep on culling problem elephants. The best option, we felt, was to try and normalize the societies.
The story moved back to Kruger, where it had begun. A new search was mounted there to find males of the right age group to ship to Pillensburg as role models. But capturing large adult bull elephants is no easy matter. It required large doses of strong tranquilizers and some heavy lifting.
The guys who were moving the big cows started developing techniques and transport vehicles. A big bull is just so much larger than a big cow and all the calves.
It was a mammoth task because it's the first of its kind in South Africa.
It is disturbing to see an animal as large and as majestic as an elephant having his life disrupted. There's a real art in keeping the animal awake enough to prevent him collapsing within the truck and sedated enough to prevent him getting upset and throwing his weight around inside that container.
When they get to the other side, they'll be held in for a few days. Perhaps calm them down a bit after the trauma of a capture. This is a very traumatic experience for them, unfortunately.
Coming up. In Pillensburg, after an arduous journey, the big bull elephants arrive.
They arrive here in the early evening, and very quietly, we open the gates and allow the elephants to move out in their own time. These bulls from Kruger just walked in and asserted themselves.
There was a number of standoffs and challenges. The younger bulls would know immediately where they stood in relation to the Kruger bulls.
Since the introduction of these big bulls, we have seen a big change of attitude in these elephants. They become more calm.
Subdued by the older, bigger males, the juvenile delinquents of Pillensburg settled down. Van Dyke's team took samples of dung to see if the animals' hormonal levels had also subsided.
The hormonal work is really an opportunity for us to understand how his hormones relate to his behavior.
Under the influence of their elders, the adolescents were producing much less testosterone, and the tendency to enter must prematurely receded.
They'd come into must less frequently, less cyclic, and for shorter duration. And
all right, that's the basic idea. Okay, good. All right. Let me clarify this. All right. Okay, here's a question. The mystery of the slaying of rhinos in the game reserve was solved. The murderers were the teenage elephants. Why did they kill the rhinos? I don't know if you were able to top that.
Well, it seems like they had just too much aggressive energy from an overproduction of testosterone and needed to figure out a way to, I guess, use that energy.
Right. Correct. So they and that was caused by sort of a prolonged and unnatural going into what they call musk, where that testosterone is produced in a radical amount, and as you said, they're like crazy, and they're like very aggressive, and therefore they start picking on the large but yet smaller animals, which were the rhinos, which they would literally gore them with their ivory tusks. Now, so what was the solution that you saw?
They brought in larger adult male elephants to like lead by example and calm them down.
Exactly. Now, part of the problem was that the humans who are trying to manage this game reserve sort of caused the problem themselves, because the elephant population was getting too large. So they said, oh, well, what makes sense? Let's get rid of the elder, like euthanasia. Let's get rid of the elder ones. We're older, you know, and by moving them to different, you know, spread them out to different game farms, etc. But by doing so, they have this unintended consequence that they basically created teenagers who didn't grow up with these role modeled elephants, and therefore were actually harmed, harming the other elephant, the rhinos, who are of course protected species, And that was the crazy thing. Now, obviously what we care about is how does animal communal life reflective of human communal life?
Well, watching this whole thing, I was thinking about how like, families who don't have two parents or two good role models or even like one good role model, or you see it in a lot of families, not necessarily in, or probably more so in, I guess, less affluent communities where there's no father figure for these boys growing up or someone for them to look up to and to learn how to be a proper person, man or woman, in society.
Exactly. Exactly. So we would think that the issue of role models and having parents who can provide literally discipline to, you know, young people and teenagers, that you think would be a feature of only of the human world. But what this whole, this is from the New York Science Times, the same dynamic, which they did not know initially, they couldn't figure it out. It took them, you know, you saw the works, it took an entire investigation. But the same model, which we're used to in our own life, that, you know, that kids who have two parents who are intact and who are responsible, who are committed to parenting children properly, or being a community that has role models that create in this, you know, community standards, is vital for the well-being of the group. It's not just elephants, but it's really not just with people, but with elephants, and it's the same. It's a remarkable thing. I mean, obviously, elephants within the animal kingdom are one of the more intelligent and sophisticated animals. You know what I'm saying? I'm not sure it's true for ants or worms. You know what I'm saying? But I don't know. Maybe they'll discover that in 100 years. I'm the world of ants. All right. So let's get into the Parsha. All right. So the Parsha, this week's Parsha, fast forward from last week's Parsha, 38 years. It is Parsha go 38 years, because last time they had been condemned to spend 38 years in the desert. It seems initially then they had the rebellion of Korach. Then that was put down. And now we're getting into the situation, and this was Parsha on the 40th year. It's the 40th year. And this was Parsha, Aaron dies and Miriam dies. So it's the end of the era. So the Torah does not mention what occurs in the desert for those 38 missing years. Okay, just giving you sort of a heads up on that. I guess the basic point was that not much happened, so there's not much to report. Okay, so let's, Mendel, read out the Parsha.
Miriam's death and lack of water. In the first month, the entire Israelite community came to the Tzin Desert, and the people stopped in Kadesh. It was there that Miriam died and was buried. The people did not have any water, so they began demonstrating against Moshe and Aaron. The people disputed with Moshe. "We wish that we had died together with our brothers before God," they declared. "Why did you bring God's congregation to this desert so that we and our livestock should die? Why did you take us out of Egypt to bring us to this terrible place? It is an area with no plants, figs, grapes, or pomegranates. Now there is not even any water to drink." Moshe and Aaron moved away from the demonstration to the communion tent entrance and fell on their faces. God's glory was revealed to them. That's interesting. Like, after 40 years or 38 years in the desert, they still hadn't, like, learned any sort of... It seems like that particular attitude was, you know, good and well established before they, you know, 40 years ago. It seems like nothing's changed.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you want to say
just an observation.
Now, again, they don't have – now, let's give the people a little bit of credit here. The people did not have any water, so there is a level of anxiety there. You're in a desert. You're in the Middle East in a wilderness with no water. That is a frightening situation.
Okay. Water from the rock. God spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the staff, and you and Aaron assemble the community. Speak to the cliff in their presence, and it will give forth its water. You will thus bring forth water from the cliff and allow the community and their livestock to drink." Moses took the staff from before God as he had been instructed. Moses and Aaron then assembled the congregation before the cliff. "Listen now, you rebels," shouted Moses. "Shall we produce water for you from this cliff?" With that, Moshe raises to him.
Rabbi Kaplan is translating the word Sela, which is generally translates a large rock, as a cliff. So it's water from the rock, not water from the cliff. But that's or whatever. Maybe he's going like some commentators who are translating that as being a cliff. All right, go on.
"Listen now, you rebels," shouted Moses. "Shall we produce water for you from this cliff?" With that, Moses raised his hand and struck the cliff twice with his staff. A huge amount of water gushed out, and the community and their animals were able to drink. God said to Moses and Aaron, "You did not have enough faith in me to sanctify me in the presence of the Israelites. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly to the land that I have given you. These are the waters of dispute, Meribah, where the Israelites disputed with God, and where he was nevertheless sanctified."
Okay, so this is now, what was the consequence of Moshe failing to comply with God's command?
He doesn't lead the Jews into Israel.
Correct, it's a big punishment. Okay. But there's so many aspects here. All right, so but I want to focus on the Ralbag. Now, and we read the Al-Ralbag, I want you to sort of think, process in your mind, what do you think is the most striking? So let's have Shana read the Ralbag.
There was no water for the people. The death of Miriam was placed next to the episode of complaints over the lack of water. This teaches us that the death of the righteous makes an impact. How? The story teaches us that if Miriam would have been alive, she would have been able to offer counsel to Moshe and Aaron when Hashem instructed them to speak to the rock. Miriam could have saved them from stumbling in this mitzvah, for she was a prophet as well, as she was older than Moshe and Aaron, and they would honor her by taking her advice.
Okay, so what do you find in this commentary surprise you?
Well, in general, about that time period is just the power that Miriam has over her brothers, that they would listen to her, as these are people who, at least Moshe specifically, or especially at least, has that relationship with Hashem, and Miriam can, I guess, stop him from hurting himself.
Right. So you. That's exactly correct. That even people as great as Moshe is the greatest, still benefit from having good friends, good relatives. Well,
I mean, it's his little sister.
Not his little sister. It's his older sister.
I'm sorry. It's his older sister.
Well, that's part of the reason why, or as the Ralbag points out, that will be part of the influence. Yeah. Thanks, Aviva. All right. So that the Ralbag makes the point that it's because she has two qualities. Number one, she's a prophetess herself. She's a Nevi'ah, so she's obviously a profoundly wise person, A. But that's not all. He puts a second reason is that she's their older. She's older than them. She has influence on them. You know, and they respect her a great deal. So she said if there was issues about the dealing with the people and the complaints of the water, the Ralbag, he gives a number of reasons. I'm just giving you one of the reasons. The reason that what the impact of, in other words, we say that the death of the righteous makes the impact. So what is it? According to the Ralbag, when the rabbis say that the death of the righteous makes an impact, what does he understand that to be?
That she was a certain calming influence on Moshe.
Not only calming, but a trusted and exalted advisor.
Okay.
Sorry, Mendel. Keep going.
The question seems to still stand, right? I mean, Moshe is from what I understand, one of the more perfected individuals, right, to be around.
The most.
Okay. So he doesn't have he doesn't understand this what's going on here?
No, but obviously the question, of course, what is the crime of Moshe? The one theory, which one of the later parshanim of the Chumash, the Or HaChaim, he identifies 12 different approaches to what was Moshe and Aaron's sin with the rock, you know, hitting the rock. We can call it hitting the rock. Okay. The Rambam underlines this phrase. Listen now, you rebels. Or he's angry at them. And God wasn't angry at them. So Moshe is losing it for a moment. You know what I'm saying? He's angry. And therefore acts impetuously. There's other components to the Rambam theory. I'm not going to all parts of that. It's a separate shear. But according to the Ralbag, if Miriam was around, what is he saying that would happen? She could have turned the ship around. So I think one immediate takeaway from this point is that you always need good friends. Literally no matter where you, no matter who you are, even if you're Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, you never outgrow having a good influence in your life. That's what the Ralbag's telling us. You never outgrow, you know, obviously as a child you need you need it in a more dramatic way, but you don't get too old or too great to have the benefit of positive role models, even if you are the ultimate role model. Because even if you're the ultimate role model, it doesn't mean that you're the ultimate role model in every circumstance. Because here Moshe Rabbeinu lost it. With, as you said, Mendel, you can understand his frustration. 40 years in the desert, and they're going back to the same old complaint. You know how frustrating that is? You've been dealing, and not only that, these people saw what happened to their parents who were complaining. They ended up dying. You think they would have there'd be a learning curve. So after 40 years to see that there's been no learning at all. Do you know how frustrating that is? I mean, it's just right. beyond words. He's feeling they have no impact. That's why he's just like yelling at. He's already at the state of just yelling at them.
I mean, yeah. Go ahead.
To this point, as perfected as Moshe was, wasn't this also one of his biggest flaws? Was how quickly, or not as how quickly, but that he relatively often became frustrated with the people?
In fact, that's according to some schools of thought. By classifying them as rebels because he got angry, because of his anger, he classified them as being rebellious. Well, God never really classified them as such. You know what I'm saying? He was quick to negative judgment. But yeah, that was a lack.
But this wasn't the first time that he became frustrated with them.
No, it was not many times. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are frustrating people. They are amkshiar. They are stiff-necked people. They are difficult. We, the Jewish people, are difficult people.
All right. Can I ask another question?
Yeah, shoot.
The Ralban makes one point about juxtaposing Miriam's death and the lack of water.
Yeah.
But is there a direct connection there also that, like, with her death, there's this lack of water?
Right. So the Chazal say, oh, from that you see that the death of the righteous makes an impact. He gives three possibilities of what that can mean. One of which is that the merit of her, you know, the fact that she's present, merits them this gift of water, of a movable well. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because she's able to, and his theory is, that her education, her impact on the people is such that she can lift the people up to the degree that they are now worthy of this miraculous gift. She's gone, people go back down to their default setting. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And as always the case, you never know what the impact of, you don't know what the impact of a person is oftentimes till they're gone, till that person is missing from the equation. You know what I'm saying? It's always, that's one of the tragedies of life. Is that we always, our natural point, a natural tendency is not to recognize the good that when we have it. And only when it's gone. And the Jewish people didn't recognize that when she was gone. They had no water and they had this problem. Okay? And which Moshe and Aaron on their own could not solve. But he provides three theories on what that means. The juxtaposition of Miriam's death, no water, and the death of the righteous makes an impact. I'm just sharing one of the three. So I want to pick up on this strand of thought, because it's really expressing a very critical point. If you really want to be successful in life, this idea of the Rambam, which is really an echo of what we said before, is a critical piece to that. So I turn to my good friend, your good friend, Scott Shapiro. Take us into the Rambam. Go ahead.
Rambam, Laws of Character Traits, Chapter 6, 1, 2.
Mm-hmm.
It is natural for a man's character and actions to be influenced by his friends.
I'm going to change this word. I don't like the word influence. It's not strong enough. Better translation.
Yeah. Actions to be drawn after by his friends and associates, and for him to follow the local norms of behavior. Therefore, he should associate with the righteous and constantly in the company of the wise, as to learn from their deeds. Conversely, he would keep away from the wicked who walk in the darkness so that not learn from their deeds. This is implied
Stop right there. So what is the Rambam telling us?
K- keep, you know, surround yourself by wise people.
Why?
Good people.
Why?
Because if you surround yourself with good people, you know, you're going to act like a good person. If you surround yourself with, like, the bad element, like they always say, like, don't hang out with, like, those kids, you know, you're going to end up, you know, something wrong or against the rules, you know.
Correct. Now, the reason, because he says it's a natural to man for his character and actions to be drawn after, to mimic, to copy. Well, basically, saying this in another way, which, like, that has been said before, is that he's saying essentially that man is a social animal.
Right.
Okay? And you're deeply affected, using it with contemporary terms, you're deeply affected by peer pressure. So if you're going to be deeply affected by peer pressure, so then who should you hang out with? Well, you should hang out with good people, with righteous people, with wise people, because then you're going to become good, righteous, and wise. Conversely, if you hang out with wicked people, bad people, you're gonna become like them. Or to say it in a bumper sticker way, I like to say it, you are who your friends are.
You can put that on a t-shirt.
You are who your friends are. Okay? You're sort of like the sum average of your friends.
As opposed to I'm with stupid.
Correct. All right. First, I wanted to believe that, but meanwhile, why are you hanging out with stupid? So that must not. It's not an endorsement.
It's not actually about where the arrow's pointing.
Exactly.
Right.
All right. Keep on going.
This is implied by Solomon's statement, Proverbs 13:20. He who walks with the wise will become wise, while one who associates with fools will suffer similarly.
Will suffer. Period. That, I mean, the King Solomon, Shlomo Melch, in Proverbs, in Mishlei, says it straight out. You walk with the wise, you become wise. You hang out with fools, you're going to suffer. It's not going to end well. I mean, that's it.
It's funny. That's really funny, because one who walks with the wise will become wise, while one who associates with fools will suffer, not become foolish.
But that's the same thing.
Okay. Right.
To be foolish is to suffer. That means the person makes a whole series of bad decisions.
A bunch of bad decisions. Okay. All right.
Yeah, keep on going there, Scott.
Similarly, Psalms 1:1 states, "Happy is the man who has not followed the advice of the wicked." A person who lives...
So that's literally the first sentence of the entire book of Tehillim, Book of Psalms. Happy is the man who's not followed the advice of the wicked. Okay? And you avoid following the advice of the wicked by not living with them. Go on.
A person who lives in a place where the norms of behavior are evil and the inhabitants do not follow the straight path should move to a place where the people are righteous and follow the ways of the good. If all the places with which he is familiar, and of which he hears reports follows improper paths, as in our times, or if he is unable to move to a place where patterns of behavior and proper because of the presence of bands of raiding troops and for health reasons, he should remain alone in seclusion as Ishik?
Echa. Lamentations
3:28 states, "Let him sit alone and be silent."
All right, so basically saying, how far do you have to go? So if you're living in a place where everybody's evil, you got to get away from that. You got to move to righteous people. But if you hear everybody's bad and you can't get to the place good because of war or health factors, then you got to live by yourself.
Like a hermit.
Go on.
Let him sit alone and be silent. If they are wicked and sinful and do not allow him to reside there unless he mingle with them and follow their evil behavior, he should go out to the caves, thickets, and deserts rather than follow the paths of the sinners. Jeremiah 9:1 states, "Who will give me a lodging place for wayfarers in the desert?"
All right, so then there's a next level. In other words, like in America, each guy could do his own thing. Nobody's forcing you to do any particular way. But there's a higher level where they won't even tolerate you to follow your own path. Then you got to run out into the caves, out to the thickets, out to the desert. Okay? That's the next level. All right. Let's go to the more positive. Okay, let's take it to the positive. Okay, Ron made his case. Here we go. All right, halacha number two, and we have Mendel.
Number two, it is a positive commandment to cling unto the wise and their disciples in order to learn from their deeds. As Deuteronomy 10:20 states, and you will cling to him. Our sages question the nature
of... to him, but Dab Kabo, Bo here for to him being God. The mitzvah to cling to God. The Gemara asks questions. Go on.
I didn't understand what you just said.
In other words, it's a mitzvah to cleave or cling to the wise and their students.
Right.
In order to learn from their weeds. And it's actually not just a good advice, but it's actually one of the 613 mitzvot. The mitzvah, the Hebrew word is Vidavka Bo, and you shall cleave to him with a capital H. You gotta cleave to God.
Right, okay.
And there's a big question. Go on.
Our sages question the nature of this command, for is it possible for man to cling to the divine presence? They resolve the difficulty, explaining this commandment to mean cleave unto the wise and their disciples. Therefore, one should try to marry the daughter of a Torah sage and marry his daughter to a Torah sage. Eat and drink with sages, do business on behalf of sages, and associate with them in all possible ways. As Deuteronomy 11:22 states, to cling to him. Similarly, our sages have directed us, saying, sit in the dust of their feet and drink in their words thirstily.
Okay, that's from Pirkei Avot. All right, now, let's break it down, a lot of parts of this. Question number six, how is our vulnerability to communal influences the same as elephants, and in what way is mankind different? All right, so we had before in the video, we had a bunch of unruly teenage, even killer elephants. What did the game wardens do? No problem. They inserted two adult elephants. No problem. We basically schooled the wild teenagers and put them in a place, and then became incredibly calm. And then there was a calmness in the elephant society. So how are we the same, or how are we different? I like this question.
Well, the issue with the elephants seems to be twofold. On one hand, you have, unruly teenagers, but I guess that's the result of not having, adult role models.
Or literally adult elephant bulls to put them in their place, and when they're acting up, they're gonna get this 5-ton adult elephant to be up in their grill. So in other words, they're not just simply modeling their excellence; they're actually literally the phrase being put in your place is true. In the elephant world.
Right.
So how is it the same and how is it different?
Well, I think it's the same in that when you're surrounded by good people, people to look up to, people who lead by setting good examples, people who are good role models, similar to the elephants copying these adult males, humans will also do what these role models are doing. They'll want to be good like them.
They're good. So that's how we are the same to the elephant society and elephant communal influence. How is it different?
Man still knows, or humankind still knows right from wrong, or should still know right from wrong, which is not something that elephants necessarily have knowledge of. I think that goes into having a set of morals, a set of values, and our free will. That we shouldn't necessarily need good people to teach us or to model being good, for us to be good, whereas the elephants are just working on instinct. And if they didn't have the adults to lead by example and to keep them in their place, they have nothing in their brain saying, this is not how you behave. They're just going to go by instinct.
That's 100% correct. In other words, the elephants, no matter how clever they are, and they are very clever, no matter how intelligent they are, and they are very intelligent, are not expressing, it's purely instinctual, it's an automatic response. In other words, no adults around, we're going to act crazy. We're going to have adults around, we're going to act calmly. You know what I'm saying? Here, there's a mitzvah to purposely put yourself in an environment where there's good people. You know what I'm saying? Part of the mitzvah is not just is to cling to God via those who reflect him to the highest extent. In other words, the righteous and the wise. You know what I'm saying? So that's still up to a decision to, to select your friends. You know what I'm saying? It's still, the power is still in your hand to choose who you're going to spend your discretionary time with. Now, when you're a kid in school, you don't have them in order. You have people you're going to hang out in recess and at lunch, but you're really sort of stuck with a lot of people. One of the good things about adult life is that you can pick who you want to hang out with. It's 100% up to you. You know what I'm saying? So that's expressing your free will. Now, what is the challenge in selecting right friends? This is not so simple.
I mean, you don't really know people until you're friends with them, kind of, right?
True. Part of that is that, as we talked about in previous classes about toxic friendships, right, in our previous class, to discern if somebody might perceive to be good, perceive to be wise, perceive to be righteous, but in fact, not so much, or a lot less than you thought. You know what I'm saying? So it's hard, and not to mention, but let's say you're attracted to this is very true in relationship. People get attracted, people, it's like a common theme in movies. The people who fall in love with bad people, because there's a part of them that really likes people who are abusive, people who like people who are, like, that's a classic stereotype in movies. Like, the girl that likes the jerk guy, you know what I mean? It's like a major theme in movies and TV. You know what I'm saying? So it's not so simple, because there'll be parts of these people that you'll be attracted to, that you do want to hang out with them. So it's a tricky mitzvah. It's not so simple. But when I remember like a week or so after Mendel was, when you guys all went on, it's like a week ago Sunday, you had the Sunday Yom Iyun Chabura program. And then Mendel, this is your idea, said, look, hey, why don't we have a Shabbaton to, in advance of the next Chabura, get more people together, we can recruit. Well, that would be an example of, by definition, filtering and getting the better friends together. You know what I'm saying? Because people who want to get together for a Chabura, people who are interested in Chaburas, by definition, are people who are interested in learning and in, it's going to be the better part of the MG community, which is going to be better than the general community. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, as a nice example of sort of like trying to find the best of the best. You know what I'm saying?
So I do.
It was your idea, but I'm just saying, but you didn't notice at the time that really is a fulfillment of the mitzvah of trying to shape your world with people who are like-minded, people who are growth-oriented, people who want to learn, people who want to grow, people who want to support each other in that endeavor. That's what I'm talking about. And then recruiting others, whether it be to recruit others whether for a Parsha class or for the fellowship or for the senior fellowship or for the Chabura program, whatever it is really trying to use skills of networking to create a community of like-minded people. I mean, the fact is, when a person decides to spend Shabbos at MJE, that means they want to spend time with a set of very excellent educators, rabbis, educators, and people who are not like the rest of Jewish New York. You know what I'm saying? So you're saying you're really doing that mitzvah. You know what I'm saying? The mitzvah of trying to spend my discretionary time with the people who will bring out the best in me. You know what I'm saying? You guys understand that? Well, I know you guys understand it, because you might have done that intuitively, but I'm just sharing you that it's not just a good thing. It's actually literally a mitzvah. You know what I'm saying? To spend time who are growth-oriented, learning-oriented, to spend time with the wise, spend time with Rabbi Wiles, Rabbi, you know, people who have Torah wisdom to share, and a community that is embracing and supporting of that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So in one hand, so this is sort of like the punchline of the whole class, is that one hand is that don't diminish the power of curating your environment, because the Ralbag puts up as a possibility that if Miriam was around, Moshe would have not stumbled and failed with the mitzvah of the water. And he could have actually ended up bringing the people into the land of Israel, and therefore setting up the temple and having basically the time of the Messiah coming right out from the beginning. That's the degree of influence that Miriam could have had based upon the juxtaposition of the two stories of the death of Miriam, no water, and the whole revolt. That's point number one. So you always, even Moshe Rabbeinu can be positively influenced. That's point number one. Simultaneous to that is that while we are very similar to the elephants, you know what I mean, that they respect, they have, will be impacted by having elders, by having good role models, we still have the free will to be able to select, to recruit, to bring together people who are growth oriented. Whether it is exerting yourself like Scott does, schleps in 2 hours from Philadelphia to spend Shabbos in Upper West Side at MJE, that really is a fulfillment of the mitzvah, trying to spend Shabbos in an environment which is positive,
yes,
which is a source of wisdom, with rabbis and educators and people who he can learn from. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean.
I'll just say, you know, and you guys who are there on Sunday, coming together for a chabura on a Sunday, being with like-minded people, being with a growth-oriented thing, people being with a rabbi or a Rabbi Sachs who can share great wisdom with you all. So that's that really is the mitzvah of sort of cleaving to God, is cleaving to those people who reflect the message of God in our day, and then moving in that direction by trying to get people to come and join a chabura, chavrusaship, a fellowship, a senior fellowship, a parsha class, a chabura, all these different things, is using the power of influence, the power of social influence to create growth-oriented communities. And that really is, that's a big mitzvah.
Do you have any recommendations? Do you and or Rabbi Sachs have any recommendations for how we or anybody could show an example or be a role model or an example to the younger people to get them more involved or be more interested?
No, I think the way you have to start is to do it like incrementally.
Okay.
Which is that, you know,
be social.
Social, and then in conversation, say, you know, I'm really enjoying this. I'm really enjoying this program. I'm really enjoying that program. Would you want to consider joining? And say, yeah, you know, you'll, because by definition, you're dealing with already at MJE, you're already dealing with a self-selected group. Because the average New York Jew, I'm not talking about New Yorker, but the average young Jewish professional Jew is not at 137 West 86th Street, is on the whole line of bars on Amsterdam Avenue. You know, if you walk by those bars Friday night or Saturday or on Third Avenue on the east side, there's, you will don't have, you may not even have to go to two bars to find a minion of Jews.
In every bar. Seriously?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. Okay, but, you know, when it's not about judging or blaming them. It's just that they didn't get the education. They didn't get the exposure. They didn't get the benefits. So, but the people already at the MJE or at davening or at classes on Monday nights and Wednesday nights, they're already in a different, they're in a much more refined state. So suggesting people to find the right people without, you know, being pushy shovey, you know, I mean, these are things you can't really recruit based upon being, you know, super aggressive, but you might find people who are interested in growth, and that's it. So that would be my suggestion is to think in these kind of terms. Look, man, the best MG fellows have been brought in by fellows. And certainly nearly every fellow who became a fellow or a senior fellow did so because after they discussed it or confirmed their thoughts by speaking to somebody who had gone through the program already. So that act is already bringing people, like-minded people together to share Torah, to grow. Great.
So MJE on the Upper West Side is pretty much not really happening for the next 2 months?
The next 2 months is the slower part of the season.
Right, okay.
First of all, two trips are going to Israel. The fellowship and the heritage trip are going to be flying out July 27th. They'll still have minyanim. It'll just be less. They're still on the east side, you know. And then everything, and also people are away. It's the summertime. People go out to the beaches. People go on vacation. People, whatever. Then after Labor Day, it gets more people show up. And stuff. But there's still plenty of people. I mean, it's just, you know, still dozens and dozens and dozens of people all in the three locations, not dozens of five. You know. That's the basic point. So that'd be a suggestion in general. Just a part of your selecting of friends is basically recruiting people to engage in meaningful Torah experience with each other. It could be a Shur Shabbos meal. You know, it could be all the above, but just trying to engage, to join people who are doing meaningful, you know, experiences, growth-oriented experiences of learning and davening and chesed, whatever they may be, and encouraging others to do the same. And as you see the appropriate situation, you know, not the hard sell, the soft sell. This is not something that the hard sell were. It's not a product or service that's subject to a hard sell.
Right, yeah.
Has the person who's essentially is interested in that and is open to that idea and is open to that you know, yeah, I am interested in exploring that. I would like that. Most of that journey has to happen within the person themselves naturally and organically. You just have to be there at the right time to share an opportunity when they're open, when they're ready for that. I mean, just to give you a simple example. There were people that I suggested the fellowship for 4 years in a row. I got no's. Year one, year two, year three. And the person told me, Rabbi, I'm interested and I'm ready. I wasn't ready last year. And I certainly wasn't ready the year before. And I was definitely not ready the year before that. Okay? So it's like you're not... Even though, because we're all on journeys, and what's appropriate at a certain time is not appropriate at the other time. So, you know, it's all about a lot about life is timing. All right, guys, something to think about. I will be at MG tomorrow night. I look forward to seeing you guys there.
Absolutely.
Have a good night.
Have a good night. Thank you.
Rabbi Penny, hold on, don't exit out. Whatchamacallit? Jesse Frankel is a solid maybe.
Solid maybe, all right.
solid maybe for Lawrence.
All right, fine. So we'll talk about, all right, so we'll talk about tomorrow. So
yeah, okay. Catch up.
All right, Matt, catch you later.
Bye. Bye, Shayna.
Night.
Night, Shayna.
Bye. Good night.